CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Sego.
Buju Anin.
Danach A. Ak Anzenu Shupwithan.
Tante.
Ay, Inuhadikay.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Hello, fans of Words and Culture. This is Melissa Spence for the Anishinaabe episodes. I'm here to share the journeys of just a few of the amazing relatives who are lovingly sharing Anishinaabe Mo'in with the entire world. When I began to research Anishinaabe Mo'in on my own, I started with children's books. I figured since I really don't know anything besides our basic greetings of Buju, Anin, or Miigwech, and a few other slang words that I won't be repeating here, I knew I was at level zero. The book I got my hands on first was the Mishomis book, The Voice of the Ojibwe, by Benton Benai. And I really appreciated it because I'm a visual learner and I'm slow. The Mishomis book was full of pictures on every single page, depicting body parts, the plant nations, our animal relatives, and basic ceremony structures. It was an amazing starting point for me, and I reread it every once in a while. I then moved on to books by the late Basil H. Johnston. I began reading the tales of Nanabuju and all the wild adventures that made me chuckle and reflect. Then it was on to the stories and poetry from the late Richard Wagamese. So moving and beautiful. All this taught me a lot about the people I come from. It's been motivating and relieving to know that there's so many different Anishinaabe out there experiencing so many different ways of living and sharing it through modern storytelling. Our next guest is someone whose career was starting to take off at the same time mine was. Wabkijik Rice was working as a local journalist in Winnipeg the first time I met him. I'd watch him on the evening news and then run into him at various media events across the city. We shared a love of heavy metal music, and at the time, I was totally unaware of his incredible talent as a writer. Wab has since published 4 books, Midnight Sweat Lodge, Legacy, and the highly recommended Moon of the Crusted Snow and Moon of the Turning Leaves. I cried my face off listening to the audio version of Moon of the Turning Leaves. In fact, just before we sat down for the conversation you're about to hear, I had just finished crying during one of the most dramatic parts of the book. Here is the wickedly talented Wabkijik Rice.
Bonjour, Wabkijik Indigenous, Makwa Ndodem, Wasak Singh Donjaba, Anishinaabe Minwa Jagana Shindao. Hi, my name is Wabkijik Rice. I'm a member of the Bear Clan of the Anishinaabe of Wasak Singh First Nation, and I work as an author.
So how's life been for you as a writer?
It's been really good. I've been very fortunate to have made a go of it. You know, I was always sort of doing it on the side when I was working as a journalist, primarily at CBC. It was kind of like a creative outlet when I was done doing my stories for the news. But 4 years ago, pretty much to the day, I left CBC so that I could work fully on Moon of the Turning Leaves, which is the sequel to Moon of the Crested Snow. And that came out just last fall. So that part worked out anyways.
What's been your relationship like with the language so far?
Oh, geez, it's been, you know, I guess a very complicated lifelong relationship, but a very fulfilling one as well. I'm 45 years old. I grew up in my home community of Wasak Singh. I heard it spoken often from family, from elders and other community members. And at school on the res, we had daily Anishinaabe Mo'in classes, but I never learned it fluently. It was something that I think maybe wasn't as prioritized at the time. And also, of course, you know, there's the trauma that a lot of the older generations carried with the language at the time too, right? So it wasn't passed on fully to me and to my generation. And I don't fault any of our community members for that. I fully put the blame on Canada for that disconnection of language and the damage that it did to our language and the fact that we have fewer and fewer fluent speakers in our community. And I believe the onus is on the state to fully restore language, but the language was always present for me. You know, I always heard it. I learned it to a certain degree, but not fluently. You know, I'm very fortunate that I can understand it pretty well when it's spoken to me, and I'm able to converse in a very basic way if I need to. But I think when I became a teenager in the 90s and, you know, had aspirations to go down to the big city, to leave the reserve, I think I personally moved a little farther from the language myself and made it even less of a priority for myself, because I thought, you know, I need to start a career. I need to go to school. And I didn't maybe necessarily see a place for the language in all that, in becoming a journalist, which is, of course, unfortunate. But after a couple of years of living in the city, I felt the pull to, you know, at least hear the language and try to speak it and nurture that bond, however weak it was for me as someone in their early 20s. So, you know, I sought out different opportunities when I was living in Toronto, going to university, you know, at the Friendship Center, within my university's Indigenous student cohort, and so on. And ever since then, it's just been, you know, a series of attempts to try to learn more, whether through community groups or language initiatives or through post-secondary opportunities, you know, just random classes here and there. So now that I have kids and they all have Anishinaabe names like I do, you know, every day it's, I think, a motivating factor to try to learn more. And I've actually made the decision to go back to school. I'm going to Georgian College in Barrie this fall to take Anishinaabe M1 because I want to learn it more fully. I don't want to be a fluent speaker. That's been a goal of mine for a while. So hopefully I'll get there.
Wow, that's so beautiful that you're going back to school for that.
Oh, the miigwech.
Yeah, the fact that there's even schools for that is pretty incredible in 2024.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's long overdue that Indigenous people had opportunities at the post-secondary level to learn language. I think it's definitely improved since when I went to university, you know, 25 or so years ago. But when I made the decision to seek out opportunities, there's quite a bit out there, you know, at the university level and at the college level. And ultimately, I decided to go to Georgian because of its proximity to me. You know, I will be doing most of the coursework virtually, but Georgian is in Anishinaabe territory, and a lot of the dialects learned there will be similar to mine. So I was able to seek that out too, which is pretty cool. So hopefully we'll get to a place in, you know, the next 10, 15, 20 years where there'll be opportunities everywhere for everyone of every linguistic background.
That is a dream that I also would love to see as well. I like how you mentioned that when you kind of like, I guess, lost the connection a little bit when you went into your career, because a lot of us, myself included, in order to get a proper job, especially in broadcasting, say, you really had to not sound native, right? Like it was, there was no way I could become a DJ on the radio or even like a voiceover artist, which I am now, having some kind of like quote unquote bush accent. So we really try to like not sound native, but then here we are trying to reconnect with our language at the same time. And it's a really strange, it's a strange conundrum if you.
Oh, I totally agree with you. It's that whole code switching thing, right?
Right.
You know? And I remember when I decided to, you know, pursue broadcasting a little more, it was interesting because like the cadence, the bush cadence or the res cadence, you know, it doesn't exist at all in what you could call mainstream broadcasting, right? Like they try to beat that out of you essentially, you know, like the way we talk on the res, we have that sort of natural uptick at the end of our, you know, sentences or statements or whatever. And when you're in broadcast journalism, especially, they say you shouldn't talk like that because you don't sound as authoritative. But I think, you know, on a natural level, as Indigenous people, I think we're inquisitive, we're, I think, jovial, we have that, you know, I think positive and eager spirit to us that I think lends to that uptick at the end of our sentences or statements or whatever. And yeah, to sort of switch that way of communicating in your mind takes some work, right? And I'm sure you fully went through that as well.
Yeah, it was definitely strange to be with family members in one part of the day and then go to work for the next day and have to sort of like mainstream my voice.
Yeah.
they want the visual of us, but they don't want us to sound like we're super native, is what I experienced. So
Yeah, I agree. And there's like, there's a version of you that they want. And as soon as you sort of break that mold in even the smallest ways, it makes them uncomfortable for sure. So it's a struggle, definitely.
Super uncomfortable. I want to go back to the classes that you were going through in your community. What was it like to go to school and actually have the language present around you? Like, that's an experience that I've never had.
It was pretty cool, you know. What we mostly learned was vocabulary, from what I remember. There wasn't a whole lot of, like, grammar structure that was part of the curriculum. And I think, you know, you have to start somewhere, right? When you're teaching a generation of kids whose parents were either shamed out of the language or had it beaten out of them, you know, due to colonialism, residential schools, day schools, the oppression of the Indian Act, and so on. So my generation, in many ways, was coming into it entirely fresh, right? And the easiest way, I think, to make those connections is just to learn, like, the words for certain trees or for animals or for the weather or the natural world around us. So those are the things I remember the most. And then, you know, you learn the basic sort of questions or commands or declarations or how to introduce yourself or whatever else. So those are the things I think really rooted me in the language at that young age. And I guess there's like a certain sense of pride there too, like all these years later, that, you know, our parents and the elders in our community were working really hard to reverse the cycles of abuse that were imposed upon them by the states. And part of that was making sure we had knowledge of our language, as small as it was at the time. So I think it's a lot more meaningful to me now, especially that I have kids and you know, I'm raising them in the city. They're not able to learn Anishinaabemowin as much as I did in the classroom setting. So I recognize those sacrifices that our community made just to make sure we had that learning. So I think what I take away the most from that time, though, is the ability to hear it. It has never sounded like a foreign language to me. And for that, I'm really grateful. Like, I'm able to discern the words and, you know, the syllables and the cadence and so on, because I've heard it spoken around me my whole life. Even though I didn't necessarily understand everything that was said, I know what Anishinaabemowin sounds like, right? And yeah, that goes back to learning it in the classroom, and I'm grateful for sure.
Let's talk about the literature now and your incorporation of language into that. So when did writing begin for you?
I was always really interested in fiction. Started when I was in high school. You know, I had an auntie, my auntie Elaine, who was one of my first teachers when I was at the school in the res. She was always really, you know, interested to know how school was going for me and my cousins and my peers who went to res school, right? By the time we were in high school, she always checked in on us. And one time she was asking me about school, and I said, you know, I really like English class. And she wondered why. And I said, well, I like reading the books and I like doing the writing assignments. And she asked me about the books we were studying. And this was back in the 1990s, right? So I listed off all these books by white dudes. And my auntie just kind of, you know, raised an eyebrow and said, uh-huh. And then afterwards, she started giving me books by Indigenous authors, people like Louise Erdrich, Richard Wagamese, Maria Campbell, Lee Marichal, all these trailblazing Indigenous authors who were doing revolutionary work at the time, right? So as like a 16, 17-year-old kid, only learning about literature through white people, it was totally eye-opening and mind-blowing, and it changed my life. Even though I already had an interest in writing, that sort of catapulted me into beginning to dream about becoming a writer. And I would go home back to the res from high school in town and just write out these stories on a pad of paper with a pen, you know, really inspired by those authors that I was finally exposed to, that, you know, I should have been exposed to through the education system, but wasn't whatsoever. And from there, I thought, you know, it would be awesome to try to become a published author one day. But all the while I was going to university for journalism, and even after I started working in the field in my early 20s, I still wrote these stories as a creative hobby on the side, and, you know, thought about ways of eventually becoming a published author. And eventually I was able to do that. My first collection of short stories, Midnight Sweat Lodge, came out in 2011. And it was entirely inspired by, you know, my experiences growing up on the res. And, you know, it wasn't like a bestseller by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, some people read it, some people were really encouraging, and that sort of motivated me to keep it going. So yeah, I give, you know, obviously full credit to my auntie for like showing me those books, but, you know, even more so the trailblazing authors that I mentioned and many more who created this circle for me and for my peers and for the generations to come to tell our stories in literature. You know, they created a place for us. And that place is just thriving nowadays, and it's only getting bigger and stronger. So I'm really, I think, honored and very thankful that I'm a part of that, for sure.
Wow. Shout out to all the aunties. So when did you start bringing the language into your storytelling?
Yeah, you know, like in that first book, Midnight Sweat Lodge, there's some small instances of the language, and I always wanted it to be a part of whatever English literature I wrote because I wanted it to be present, you know, much like those times in my early journalism career. I wanted Indigenous people and our culture and our language to be present, and I took the same approach with literature, even if it was just like having a miigwech in there here and there, or, you know, an ani, or, you know, just a basic introduction or something. So it was, I think, for me, crucial for the sake of representation to do that. And then when my first novel came out, Legacy, there was a bit more of it. And then with Moon of the Crested Snow, which, you know, was much, I think, more notable book than my first two, it was important for me to have it there, too, because it was this story about a new future for Anishinaabek, a new future for Indigenous people, an opportunity to start over with this, you know, potential world-ending event. And, of course, I wanted language to be part of our future, you know, and I wanted to show how a community of Anishinaabek could turn to their language, turn to their culture to seek guidance in the immediate aftermath of this cataclysm, right? And find hope and find inspiration in that. So I think I made more of an effort to include the language in Moon of the Crested Snow. And then when the opportunity to write the sequel, Moon of the Turning Leaves, came up, the idea behind that story was to place it, this community, even farther into the future. So I felt like it was my responsibility, my obligation, to show the language much more strongly in the second book of the series. So I worked a lot harder on including it in the second book. And for me, it was also reflective of my own personal journey with the language and some of my recent efforts to try harder to learn it. The instances of the language are far from perfect in any of the books that I've written, but, you know, they're my attempt and they're sort of my personal motivation to work harder, right? And of course, like, when people connect with those bits of the language, other Anishinaabek, that's really special. But also, you know, more Indigenous people who broadly connect with that intention, I think, is really cool too. And then just to show people of settler backgrounds that the language is there, and here are how some words look in a novel, and here are some things to consider about our language, right? So yeah, there's a lot of thought, a lot of intention behind all that, but I'm just, you know, humbled by the opportunity to do it, and hopefully I do our language and our people justice.
Without giving too much away, I just wanted to say I'm halfway through the second book. I was crying my face off like an hour ago because it was like a really dramatic part. But I really love how you sprinkle the language throughout the books, especially in the first novel where you like put the word there and then kind of describe what it means for people who might have no idea what that means. Like, you really made it approachable.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for bringing that up, because it's really difficult to know how to I guess, present it and to translate it too for people who aren't familiar with it. So when I had the first draft of Moon of the Crested Snow, the first book done, I was taking it around to, you know, a few different publishers to see who was interested. And the publisher who did take it on, ECW Press, through Susan Renouf, who ended up editing it, they were eager about it. And Susan herself, especially, was really encouraging when it came to the language component of it. So in the first draft that I ever wrote, every bit of language is mostly spoken in dialogue, but every bit of language was always translated directly. So a character would say something in the language and then, you know, say it in English immediately after. So, for example, you know, Mud Bin Mumpy, he said, sit down here, right? So when Susan read it, she said, yeah, it's great that you have so much of the language in here, but why do you have all these translations right after? She said, that's kind of redundant, and people wouldn't speak like that in real life. You know, if there's a language speaker talking to another person who knew the language, they wouldn't just repeat the same thing in English for them because that person would understand, right?
Right.
And I said, I just thought I had to translate it for people who don't understand. And she said, well, yeah, you do have to give them an idea of what it means, but you don't have to translate it directly like that. So you can, you know, translate it through action. You can translate it through some of the other context of the scene. You can have another character in dialogue respond in English, you know, which sort of would reveal what that original statement in Anishinaabemowin was, you know. And she said, there's all these different ways you can do it. And also, you don't necessarily have to do it. You know, let the reader do the work. Let the language be itself and be proud of it. And that was hugely empowering, you know, to have a white woman in her 60s from Toronto tell me, an original Rez guy, that's the way I can do it, you know, because I just thought, oh, I got to cater to white people. You know, that's just what you think when you're starting out with these kinds of things, right? So I was like, oh, this is awesome, you know, and I was really motivated to, you know, just let the language be itself and find different interesting ways to translate it for readers who don't understand it. So I took that spirit into the second book too, and is with a different publisher and with a different editor. But my editor, Rick Meyer, for the second book, he fully agreed with that approach too. And, you know, even with much more of the language in the second book, you know, he left that entirely untouched. He's like, that's, you know, that's your language, that's your people, that's your way of expressing yourself. I'm just here to help with the English part of it. And, you know, if there are things that maybe I'm confused with in terms of the language, you know, you can just explain it to me. And if we need to explain it better in the actual text, then we'll work on ways to do that, right? So it was never a barrier, you know, with both of these recent books. And it was never a barrier with my first two books either, because I worked with an Indigenous publisher for those two books, right? So I've had a really fortunate, I think, entry into literature when it comes to using our language and really being proud of it and making it a central part of the story. And yeah, I always give credit to Susan, especially, for allowing me to, I think, flourish in that spirit.
I love it. I love it so much. I love that there's not just our language sprinkled throughout your books, but things about our culture, like the character Scott in the first novel. And the way he's portrayed as like the Wendigo was really cool for me to read or listen to in the audiobook. And it's just cool to hear the language in an audiobook style and reading it like analog style.
You know, with the audiobook, oh man, I was so fortunate to have Billy Morassi do the audiobook of both the Moon novels. He's, of course, you know, renowned Cree actor from Northern Manitoba. And when I was approached about the audiobook for Moon of the Crested Snow, I said, well, I don't want to do it. Definitely not. Because, you know, I don't have acting chops. I can't bring the drama required for this story or the drama that I would want to hear as the author, right? So they had a list of actors that they presented me with, and Billy was on the list, and right away he was who I wanted. Of course, he's Cree, right? So, you know, he doesn't have a knowledge of Anishinaabemowin, but the two languages are similar enough that he can pronounce it and understand it well, right? And oh, he just breathed a whole new life into the story. And when Moon of the Turning Leaves was going to come out, and they asked me about an audiobook narrator for that one. I was like, well, I want Billy right away. You know, it was sort of no question around that Billy, I wanted him there for the second one. And yeah, he just knocked it out of the park once again. So yeah, I'm glad you're able to, you know, experience it, the audio version. And yeah, I think, you know, for a lot of readers, a lot of listeners, it really enhances the experience. Thanks to Billy.
I'm so into it. Like I cried during the first book and I was like, wow, that's powerful. Then I cried even harder in the second book.
Oh, well, you know, that's, I always apologize for making people cry, but I remind people, you know, I cried too when I was doing it. So
I rarely cry. Yeah. There's not many books that make me cry or like actually feel things like that, where I got to like put it down and be like, whoo, that was a lot.
Oh, mi gosh, Melissa, right on.
And I love the fact that there's this one little part in the first book where you were there in the truck and there's country music and the guy's like, why are you listening to this? Because I know that you love metal music and we share that commonality. And it was just cool to hear finally someone mentioning metal in like an indigenous story.
Well, yeah, that's cool. I'm glad. I know I definitely like have people like you in mind in writing that. But like part of that, too, is, you know, humanizing res people. Yeah. On a day-to-day level, right? Like, there's so much we have to deal with. And you can relate with this, having worked in media for a long time. Like, there's just so many stereotypes we have to deal with, right? Like, so many things that we have to explain about ourselves. And ultimately, we just want people to know that we're human beings, too. You know, we have, like, the same desires, same objectives as everybody else, no matter where they live, right? And that also means that we listen to metal, we listen to country, we like watching sports, we watch soap operas like the YNR, you know, all this stuff is who we are as indigenous people. So yeah, showing glimpses of that, I think, is important in a novel.
Wob's stories have really taken our voices as Anishinaabe to new levels. You could even say Moon of the Crusted Snow is a horror book. It's dark, it's heartbreaking, but funny and relatable. And it's refreshing to have his unique perspective out there in the world. Wob is going to teach me a few new words in Anishinaabe Moen.
I'm sitting at my kitchen table, so I'll just grab some random words from what I see around me. So my computer is on the table. Table is Dopewin.
Dopewin?
Dopewin. Yep, Dopewin. I'm sitting on a chair, and chair is Pubwin.
Pubwin?
Pubwin, yeah. Yeah, I'm looking outside, and my car is parked in the driveway, and car is Dabon.
Dabon.
Dabon, yeah. So Dopewin for table, Pubwin for chair, and Dabon for car.
Dopewin and Pubwin have, like, the same sound to them.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, like, you know, a really expert language teacher could tell you what that means, because, like, there's these interconnected sort of syllables, right?
Yeah.
So Dopewin, Pubwin, you know, that win at the end, that probably means something that connects it to. I don't know what that is yet, but hopefully I'll know someday.
I'm noticing that, too, that there's a lot of components in each word that they're all connected. They all describe the same thing, which is so beautiful. I'm excited to learn more as well.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, I agree.
Thank you so much for your time, Wob.
Miigwech, this has been a blast. Thanks for having me.
You can find Wobgejik Rice's books all across Great Turtle Island, preferably, though, from your local independent book retailer. And if they don't have it, make a request for them to get it. I've seen Moon of the Crusted Snow and Moon of the Turning Leaves all over Canada at major retailers and even in airports. I myself scored both copies online, and the audio versions are wonderful. I highly recommend. Wobgejik Rice is moving the path forward, and I'm excited for all of his future works. Well, this is it for me, Melissa Spence, in the Anishinaabe Moen episodes for Words and Culture. Thank you so much, Chimigwech, for sharing your time with me. It's been such an honor to not just be a part of this amazing language series, but to meet every guest. My language journey is in its early stages, and I'm confident over time, I too will be fluent in Anishinaabe Moen. Thank you, Kim Wheeler, for your trust and support. This has been a beautiful experience for me. Next on Words and Culture, we welcome host Madeline Alakarialuk, who will share about her language, Inuktitut.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin.
Soko seni denit e minen yuji hina.
Eko se.
Kako udao. We'll see you again.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby.